Welcome to the Legally Sound Smart Business Show, your weekly look at legal news and questions in the business world. Here are your hosts, Nasser Pasha and Matt Staub.
All right, welcome to Legally Sound Smart Business. This is Nasser Pasha.
And this is Matt Staub.
Okay, we have a lot to cover today, right, Matt? This is a action-packed, newsworthy podcast.
Yeah, there's some good stories. I don't know what makes it more action-packed than any of the other episodes. It's the same amount of stories and questions, but...
That's true.
Maybe it's just the substance of them. There are some good stories and some good... A wide range of different states, too. So there's some good stuff today.
Yeah, very educational. This is what we do. We cover business legal news. And we also answer some of your business legal questions. And you can send them in to ask@legallysoundsmartbusiness.com. And also go to our website, Legally Sound Smart Business, and submit it in the form as well.
Okay, we're going to start out on the East Coast and work our way over. So the first story today is in New York, and it comes with a new law that was passed for paid sick leave. I guess in New York, it's mandating that employers give employees 5 days of paid sick leave a year. Which I'm assuming that I'm not as familiar as New York with other people, but I'm assuming that wasn't the case before. And some businesses probably had it and other ones probably didn't offer the same sort of thing to their employees.
Yeah. And this is starting in April, but this is a big deal because, first of all, most states don't have any kind of requirement for sick leave, though a lot of employers do give it. And if you do give it, then yeah, you have to follow it if you have some kind of policy. But Texas doesn't have it. New York doesn't have it. New York State, that is. And also California doesn't have it, except, of course, San Francisco and maybe a couple other cities here and there peppered out throughout the State of the Union. So this is pretty significant for businesses. This is a pretty big expense to require this.
Yeah, obviously it depends on how many employees they have. And they do talk about the cost. But I think it's something good, too, because this is how I view it is if you were... I guess you weren't forcing your employees to come in if they were sick, but there was an incentive for them if they were sick to come in because they wouldn't get paid if they didn't come in and work. But now you're allowing those people to stay at home as opposed to them coming into work and getting more people sick.
True.
And then production of maybe you just have a bunch of sick people in there and maybe it makes those people sick and they just give up and have to go home or stay a few days. I mean, I think this could be beneficial. So I don't think the cost is as bad as some people think.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, some business owners they picked a restaurant and they say that it's going to be about $100,000 expense for them because they anticipate that they may have to hire more people to cover those people that are taking off. But who knows? I mean, that seems a little crazy to me. But I also don't like separating sick leave from vacation leave. I like the concept of paid time off, PTO time, that kind of gives the employee the discretion, okay, these are the number of days you have, take them for whatever you want, whether you're sick or not. That way, the employer doesn't have to go through the stupid process of figuring out whether they're actually sick and all that stuff, you know?
Right, and we should also mention that this is for businesses with 5 or more employees, so hopefully it's not the same sort of thing that was happening with Obamacare, where
yeah,
some employers were dropping employees just to, that would be a pretty extreme thing. In this case, for 5 paid sick days, but I don't think it's a bad thing. I like it. I'm in favor of it. We'll see if it stretches to other parts of the state or if things kind of expand out in California too, outside of San Francisco.
Yeah, and I know a lot of employers and businesses may complain about some of these types of labor law restrictions, but if you take a look at other Western countries in Western Europe and other places in the first world, these kinds of laws are very mild compared to the number of sick leave days that are required, as well as maternity leave and things like these that a lot of these states in the United States don't even come close to. California is probably the strictest, but it's not surprising to also see these kind of laws coming out of New York.
Or you can just be like my mom, who's a teacher and has accrued a full, she could technically take a full year off with her accrued sick days that she had.
Wow.
I would assume she'll probably just get paid for that once she retires. I don't know how that's going to work, but...
Now, she's in Indiana, right?
Yeah, I just told her to take a full year off and then come back.
Well, because
they have to pay you for it.
The reason I'm asking, because there's some states that allow, you know, for example, you never lose your vacation days, for example, in California. But in Texas, for example, it's different. You actually have to use it or you lose it. And so every state's different. This is why a lot of times people talk about where to conduct business at, which state is more business friendly than the other. These are the things that matter to them.
That is a consideration. And for the ones that do have the use it or lose it, there's always the people that plan in advance throughout the year and the people that just all wait towards the end.
Yeah.
And if you have a bunch of employees like that, then everyone just takes off at the end of the year and then you're kind of in trouble.
Yeah.
But I don't know, it's a balance and I'm in favor of this new law. It's not too much. 5 days isn't a huge amount in the whole scheme of things. So
for sure. Well, all right, let's go to our first question.
Yeah.
This is a long one. I hope you can do it. I know you always complain about the log one, so.
I was trying to figure out where it was. I think it says it in the question. I'll just read it.
I think New York, right?
Yeah, I think so. I'm the owner of a small marketing firm. I'm looking to expand my business and helping organizations gather funding. The organizations I'm seeking to help are large, successful research and technological development programs, things of that nature. Currently, my business is located in New York. However, I am planning on soliciting for these organizations in states like Washington, Virginia, and possibly a few other states. I'm wondering what licensing I would need to be able to do so legally and what steps I need to take. I appreciate any and all helpful information you're able to give. Thank you. I guess it is in New York.
I wonder, did they say in states like Washington and Virginia and possibly a few others, do they mean Washington, D.C. or Washington State? If it was Washington State and Virginia, those are kind of random states to be looking for funding. But
yeah,
I don't know.
I thought the exact same thing. I mean, especially if you're based in New York, that's Washington State's pretty far away. But I would assume D.C., but...
And it's a little restricted. Yeah, I'm only going to look in the state of Washington and the state of Virginia. Screw the other states of the country.
All right, well, I think we answered the question.
No, we did. Okay, so the answer to the question, this is a difficult one because I see a lot of issues here, right? This person's a marketing firm, a small marketing firm, and they're trying to represent other businesses, their clients, in order to gather funding, okay? Now, they're a marketing firm, so I don't know if they're just preparing the advertising and marketing material, but then they also say they're going to be the ones soliciting. So this is a big issue because they have to look for all these FINRA regulations and also to make sure that they're not considered a broker-dealer under the SEC. That is that you're soliciting investment on behalf of for private equity. And so I would take a look at that to make sure that you don't fall under that category. I think that's a big risk. And so watch out for that first thing. And then as far as other licensing goes, well, I guess that's what they're concerned about is what kind of licensing. So I would really break it down to whether or not you're defined as a broker-dealer. It's not something that is very easily defined, and there are a number of exceptions as well. And so that's difficult. But then also there's a question of whether or not you should be licensed as a separate entity in those particular two states, Washington and Virginia, or possibly Washington, D.C. as well. So now on that, each state has their own rules. So for example, and this is just an example, California, if you're operating any doing any intrastate business within the state, then you have to register as a foreign entity. In Texas, if you're doing business and you have any kind of substantial transactions here, then you also have to register as a foreign entity. But how that is defined, the devil's in the details, and it matters whether you have bank accounts here and offices, etc. So again, this is something, I know it's a bad answer and it's not what this person is looking for, but you really need to sit down with an attorney before you conduct business. Worst case scenario is get the SEC breathing down your throat.
The way the question's worded too, it's hard to tell exactly what they're doing. They're a marketing firm and they're helping organizations gather funding. So you touched on it and I think you did a good job answering the question, but it's difficult to tell how much involvement they're going to have or if they're just finding people for these businesses or taking it to another level and actually brokering them?
Well, I think the biggest problem is that word soliciting, right? And so to take some value out of this question beyond just what they're asking, I think a lot of people will get into the trap of wanting to raise money for other people. And just because you're helping them out, you want a finder's fee, that may work. But then if you're part of the negotiation and so forth and actually publicizing that this person's looking for private equity investment, then this is a big issue. It shouldn't be taken lightly.
Yeah, I agree. You said this is a difficult question. I think we did a pretty good job on it. And by we, I mean you. But
well, it's a long answer. So we probably lost half our listeners by now. So, but we have the dedicated few, though, that have got this far.
I know I stopped listening a long time ago.
Oh, so did I. So we're in the same boat with that.
All right. Well, we started in New York and we're all the way in California now, specifically San Diego.
This is fresh off the press, right?
Yeah, fresh off the press.
So to speak.
So it's a class action lawsuit involving the Union Tribune, which I believe is the biggest newspaper in San Diego, right? I would think.
Oh, yeah. I don't think there's any other newspapers that I know of. Maybe the Reader or something like that, but it's not really a newspaper, right? There's some other online publications that are getting a lot of readership, though.
I'm most familiar with the Union Tribune, and I know they've bought out a bunch of smaller newspaper companies recently, so we'll just assume it's the biggest one. But anyways, there was a lawsuit involving the newspaper delivery. I was going to say paper boys. I don't know if that makes sense. The news carriers.
Well, yeah, they're not paper boys anymore. They're these guys in vans with a bunch of newspapers in their back, but yeah, same thing. Yeah.
So it's a class action lawsuit that boiled down to the Union Tribune was classifying them as independent contractors, and what this lawsuit came down and said is they should have been classified as employees. I mean, we've gone over the employee independent contractor thing a bunch of times in this podcast, but I think in this situation, there was some expenses, specifically the gas expenses, huge, and they weren't getting reimbursed for that because they were classified as independent contractors when it should have been employees, and they should have been getting reimbursed for that.
Yeah, and that's a huge difference, right? If you have about 100 delivery men that are, or women that are delivering newspapers for you, and you don't have to compensate them for their mileage or their gas or those related expenses, or even the time that they're spending on the road, that's a big difference, right? So this is a matter of control, of course. And what's interesting, they mention in the complaint that these guys actually signed an independent contractor agreement. And this is a classic scenario, right?
Yeah.
You have an employer that wants to classify these people as independent contractors. So they give them an independent contracting agreement, but they still maintain all this control over them as if they were an employee. And of course, the state of California and pretty much every other state is going to ignore that aspect of the contract and say, look, this is pretty much an employee. The only difference is that you're calling them an independent contractor. And so even a big company like this that you would think would have their ducks in a row failed to comply with this very complicated and easy to miss law.
Yeah, that is a classic thing that people think that just because they label someone as a independent contractor that it's going to be viewed that way. I guess at least it shows a little bit of understanding that the person thought they were an independent contractor. But yeah, in this situation, in other situations, it's not going to mean anything if there's ever an issue of how they were classified. What gets me on this is the award was, I thought, was a little under $5 million, but the attorney's fees were pretty substantial in this too. I don't know.
$6.1 million in attorney's fees. And that's not uncommon for class action lawsuits. And people joke, right? In class action lawsuits, I'm sure everyone has been in part of one class. You know, I've been a part of a few. My law school had one. My Netflix, if you purchase any stock, a lot of times. And what do you end up getting? Maybe a dollar or two or some kind of weird discount on something. But the attorneys for these class action lawsuits always do pretty well if it's successful, of course.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I wonder how much these people got for the reimbursement of their expenses. I mean, because driving around, it's expensive. I know when I, not to bring it back to my old days, but when I used to deliver pizzas, I got 50 cents a delivery for gas, which that's when gas was much cheaper.
You're kind of commenting on, too, is if you have employees that are on the road and they're still within the control, and we're not talking about from home to work, we're talking about, like, especially in the good classic cases, delivery, then you actually have to reimburse them for expenses. It's part of it. And so there's different ways to do that. There's the IRS table and so forth that has recommendations based on mileage and so forth, or you can do it on actual expenses. There's different ways to calculate that.
Yeah, I'm sure there was probably instances of the people that were delivering these newspapers to getting in some sort of traffic accident or car crash. And
yeah.
I'm curious what the Union Tribune did at that time.
That's true.
Because, oh, these are independent contractors, not our problem.
Exactly. It's a good point. Oh, by the way, the other online newspaper that is really starting to get some traction is the Voice of San Diego.
Oh, yeah. Some good stuff on there.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest competitor, at least online, besides the other local news channels.
All right, here is the next question. I legally own an LLC business in New York State. Currently, the LLC is in my name, and I am looking to change that. My ex is the owner of the business, and he is seeking to take sole ownership of the business and transfer everything into his name. I am wondering what steps need to be done to do this all correctly and efficiently. Thank you for your help. So they said the LLC is in my name, but my ex is the owner. I guess I don't understand how that works right off the bat. But.
Yeah. Maybe he's the one that's supposed to be the owner. And I don't know what she means by ex. Wait, I don't even know if this is a he or she. Maybe I'm just putting it in here, but I don't know if it's an ex-husband or ex-wife or is an ex-boyfriend or girlfriend, but
yeah,
I guess it doesn't matter. This isn't a division upon divorce, which New York has its own separation of property, including business ownership. So I don't think that's the question. I think the question is, how do we transfer it, right? How to transfer ownership?
That's what it looks like, yeah.
Well, that's easy. So there's a difference between corporations and LLCs. This is pretty basic. Corporations, you own shares of a company. And in an LLC, you own membership units, okay? And an owner of a company is called a member. And so all you need to do, and it seems like what he or she is saying, is that they own a membership interest in the LLC, but their ex is the one that actually should be owning the business. So I guess they just need to transfer the units over to them. Quite simple.
Yeah, I think that's right. They should have some sort of operating agreement that has maybe guidelines on how to do that. If not, you can look to the default rules. This is in New York State, so I don't know. I'm not as familiar with the default rules for the state, but this should be a pretty painless process.
Yeah, it's mostly just paperwork, and there shouldn't be too many tax implications. Or what you can do is have your ex purchase it for a certain value, and then you assign the units over. And so you would basically need three documents, a purchase agreement and an assignment of the units, or you can combine that into one, and then also your operating agreement, which will reflect the new ownership.
Bingo. All right. I think we nailed that one.
Yeah. Just look up online and download that, and good luck to you.
All right. And I'm sorry about your ex. I don't know in what stage that is, but our sympathies go out. All right. Let's take a break here. We got some exciting news for the firm.
Yeah. We took our first Bitcoin client, meaning that they're paying us in Bitcoin, which is pretty crazy and fun. I think we were kind of scared at first. Not really scared is the wrong word, but it's definitely a different thing. You have to kind of look at it in a different way. But in reality, I think we have it set up so that it automatically converts to US dollars right away. And so there's very little risk on our end. So, but that was pretty neat, a little different, right?
Yeah, it's definitely cool. And as far as I know, I don't know if there's any other law firms in San Diego that are accepting Bitcoin. I haven't run across any. That's pretty cool if we're the first ones or even the only ones. But it's when you mention Bitcoin to someone, you'll get such a wide range of responses from anything from people that are really dived in deep to it and know about it to people that are just familiar with it to people that have no idea what it is. I mean, I've had some conversations with people in the last week where they have no idea what Bitcoin is, and I explain it to them and they think it's some sort of crazy scheme. But I guess that's how the first time someone explained it to me, that's how I felt, but I think it was just how they were explaining it.
Well, the big problem was is finding an accountant for our client that can deal with this Bitcoin stuff, because to me, it's just a mess to deal with. And not only does the accountant have to be familiar with what a Bitcoin is, which that's a whole conversation in itself, but then also be able to understand the tax implications of how to do that, which I don't think is that complicated again, but just because it's so new and unfamiliar.
Yeah, and the IRS hasn't provided like full guidance on what's really going to happen. So there's a little bit of a mystery out there. But yeah, I've talked to a couple CPAs about it, and it's the same sort of thing as everyone else I've talked to. Some people have no idea what's going on. Some people are very interested. So
yeah. The problem with Bitcoin too with people is that they think that if they get paid in Bitcoin, that means that they don't have to pay any taxes on that, which is completely not true.
Right.
And I don't know why, for some reason, because it's a virtual currency, they're not equating it to a real currency. But so that seems strange to me.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And we'll continue to accept Bitcoin.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting.
All right, let's get into, so it's still January, so we're still doing Obamacare stories, at least one every single podcast. And this one deals with small businesses. I guess it's kind of similar to one of the other articles we talked about with the sick workers.
Yeah.
This is small businesses sending sick workers to the exchanges instead of having them on their plan and drive up the price.
Yeah. So let's just break this down for a second. A lot of bigger companies, again, this may be a loss to some of our listeners that are small, medium-sized businesses, but when you get up to 100-plus employees, a lot of times these employers actually elect to self-insure. And the problem with that is, first of all, self-insuring, there's a lot of issues with that. It's highly regulated. But the problem is if you have individuals, employees that get sick too often, just like with any other insurance company, that poses a higher cost for them. And so just as insurance companies were accused of doing before, is they want to drop coverage. So instead of dropping coverage, they want to pay their employees to go to the exchange instead of being part of the self-insured plan of the employer. And so I think this is some kind of loophole, but I'm not sure if it's still legal because people are saying, well, this could be termed as discrimination for a disability, for example. And so I wonder if this is the best practice, but I understand, you know, when you get to that level of employees, I understand wanting to save costs for that.
That's the first thing that popped into my head. Was this some sort of age discrimination issue? Or I guess it doesn't necessarily have to even be age discrimination, but I'm guessing that the people that they're telling to do this are more likely older than they are younger, but who knows?
And it's good to know that in the original Affordable Care Act, I should say at least one of the drafts, who knows how many there was this anti-dumping provision which prohibited employers from creating a separate pool for those high-risk candidates. But that's not in the law, so this actually allows them to do this technically.
We did a story on this every podcast this month, and it's everyone's a different way that businesses are finding loopholes in the Affordable Care Act and trying to get around things. And so I'm sure next time will just be something different. It's just all these different loopholes that people are trying to find.
This kind of goes into our next question. A person asked, what sort of benefits do I need to provide for my employees? And this person's from California. And I'm just thinking, like, for smaller businesses, I don't think it's about looking for loopholes, because even if you find it, the amount of savings you're going to get and all that, I just don't think it's worth it. I think part of embracing benefits to your employees should be a way for you to attract good personnel. Even if unemployment is high or relatively high right now, I think it's still very difficult to find good employees. And instead of giving them a higher wage, you provide benefits and you get some kind of tax benefit from that anyway, you might as well learn to embrace it, because I don't think a lot of these aspects, especially for businesses under 50 employees, is going to change anytime soon.
Right. I agree with you completely. To me, benefits are more of a way to find people that want to work for you and keep them there.
Yeah.
So if you offer good benefit packages, especially for people with children, that could be the reason that they chose your company, chose to work for you, or chose to stick around and not go somewhere else. That's what benefits mean to me more than anything else.
Exactly. And compare this to bigger companies. In bigger companies, the first expense is salaries, and usually the second expense that they have is their benefits, right? But for small businesses, that's usually not the case. In fact, the benefits is usually a very small portion of their overall expenditure. But just as cash doesn't always result in the best incentive for workers, these kinds of extra benefits, what have you, these insurance plans are actually a nice economical way to attract good talent.
Yeah, and we don't know how many employees that this person had that wrote in the question, but it's definitely the analysis that people make when they look for a job. Let's say you have a couple offers out there from some different employers, and one's going to pay you less salary, but it also has this tremendous benefits package. You have to look at that too. It's not just the salary you're going to get paid, but if you're going to be saving a lot more money, or maybe the matching on the retirements they have for you is really good. And it's, you have to look at that stuff as opposed to just straight up salary. Hopefully all prospective employees do that, but I'm guessing they probably don't.
And so to answer the question directly, what sort of benefits do you need to provide? The answer is nothing. If you're under 50 employees, then there is no so-called employer mandate. And in most states that I know of, there's no other requirements of benefits.
All right. Well, there's a pretty interesting story that's out there this week about one person's opinion for businesses to never do online banking. It's not saying never have a bank account. That's a different story, but it's never do online banking. And I guess the biggest reason why it's saying this is just the security involved, just comparing a personal account to a business bank account. I guess in a personal account, if there's any sort of fraud with the online banking, then it pretty much always get their money back. It's usually not a big issue, but with businesses, and there's a lot of stories out there of this happening recently, some fraudulent things that have happened and businesses have been out of luck with trying to recover that money.
I get the argument, but I think we need to put this in context first, right? The fraud is the same thing as someone breaking into your home. You know, it's an intentional thing. It's not, has nothing to do with how secure the bank is. That means someone purposely stole your identity or got your login credentials and somehow transferred funds out to them, right? And so the fact that the bank is liable, I should say they're insured against these kinds of acts for personal accounts, to me, that's a luxury. But when it comes to business, I mean, to say that we shouldn't do online banking is like, you know, we shouldn't fly because we might get into a crash. You know, I mean, I don't think it's as prevalent as it seems, but of course, it's a risk. It could happen.
Yeah, and I think it's just a couple of those stories that have been out there with businesses that have had this happen to them. But yeah, like you said, it's just look at the pure numbers on how many businesses this is happening to and how many it's not. And it's more likely than not, it's never going to happen to your business. So I think it is a little bit of an overreaction to say never do online banking for your business. But I guess for this guy, it's not the case.
And I'm not sure if this is correct or not. He's also saying that for personal credit cards, you're not liable for fraud and so forth. But I'm not sure if you have a business credit card like I do, I'm not sure if I'm on the hook in the same way if somehow someone steals those numbers. I'm not sure if that's the case because, again, staying away from online banking doesn't solve that problem. But I think this is just kind of fear-mongering a little bit from this cybersecurity blogger.
Well, yeah, so I think he said he just takes checks and goes to the bank like the old-fashioned way used to be. It seems like a waste of time.
I do like, though, this is Bloomberg Businessweek that covered him, and they do put it in a perspective. They say that he's got surveillance cameras around his home, keeps a shotgun in his office, and has thought through how best to protect his own bank accounts. And so obviously he has that kind of disposition already, but I don't know, to each its own as far as how risk adverse you are.
Yeah, it's the overarching issue is just security in general. So there's obviously things you can do to enhance your security. And the more secure you can make everything, especially technology, the better off you are. It's just another consideration that needs to be taken.
Yeah. Well, I don't think we have time to cover our last article. We were going to cover Justin Bieber, but because I mean, the news has just been so prevalent for him because he was arrested or something like that. But we just ran out of time, unfortunately.
I'm really glad we didn't have to talk about that. I could care less about anything that ever, any story. I wish there was a way that I could just block any story about him out from popping up on my computer at all. I opened up my iPad yesterday and I had 3 news breaks from CNN. I was like, oh, these are, usually you don't get a lot of those. These must be important. All 3 Justin Bieber. It's like, this is not news. This is not news at all.
Well, there's a video going around too. I think one of the network news channels was interviewing a congressman and then they broke to cover the Bieber story. And that's just embarrassing. I, you know, by the way, I think there is, and if I find it, I'll link to it. There is an app or a plugin that you can use to plug into your browser that can eliminate all mention of certain things on news sites and so forth. But I'll have to take a look. I think people use it for sports, you know, in case they're, you know, recording a game or something.
Or maybe when people are obsessed with Breaking Bad so you don't see the spoilers.
Exactly. If there's not one, then I'll invent one by next week and I'll sell it on air.
That'd be cool.
Either one.
I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. All right. Very good. And I'll sponsor the podcast under that company as well.
I'm glad I was able to make some sort of TV reference. I was listening to last week's episode and I realized I referenced The Office, Friends, and Saved by the Bell. All 3, I mean, The Office is more recently off the air, but the other 2 have been off the air for both over 10 years. I mean, Saved by the Bell's been off for like, what, 20 years? I don't even know. Kind of embarrassing.
Yeah, well, what's funny is I lost my ritual today. I didn't watch The Office, but I did watch 15 minutes of Saved by the Bell, believe it or not.
All right.
It just happened to be on.
Yeah.
So, worked out. Well, okay, that's our episode. Episode number 15. Correct, right?
Yep.
Okay, cool. And we'll see you next week. Thank you for listening in.
Yeah, keep it sound and keep it smart.
This has been the Legally Sound Smart Business Show with your hosts, Nasser Pasha and Matt Staub. The Legally Sound Smart Business Show is your weekly look at legal news and questions in the business world. Legally Sound Smart Business is a podcast that is intended but not promised or guaranteed to be current, complete, or up to date, and should in no way be taken as an indication of future results. No attorney-client relationship is created by listening or submitting questions to the podcast. The podcast does not constitute legal advice. but rather is offered only for general informational and educational purposes. You should not act or rely on any information in the podcast without first seeking the advice of an attorney. The opinions expressed in the podcast reflect the views of those individuals and do not necessarily represent the views of any other individual or business. For more information about the Legally Sound Smart Business Show, visit legallysoundsmartbusiness.com.
These aren't requirements for small businesses. You know, I say small businesses, particularly the home affordable, or not home, health, what is it? Healthcare Affordable Act. What is it?
Affordable Care Act.
You know, there's the Home Affordable Care Act, right? Or Home Affordable and Mortgage Act, or anyway, that passed in 2007 or 8. But anyway, I got confused. So, all right, where was I? In California, the threshold's lower than 50. I believe it's 15, I think, but don't quote me on that. Actually, we need to look that up to make sure that's correct. And then, all right, I just got totally thrown off by all this. Let's go on to the next article.
Yeah, we can cut that.